The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
And welcome to the final furlong show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, our Wednesday Trainer Talk edition, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. It is time to get on board the Bullet Train. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Delapina, with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and excited for this Hall of Fame edition of the show. Carl Nafsker is going to be here with us from 6 to 6:30 Eastern Time, and then we'll be joined by Roger Atfield for the second half of the show. Really looking forward to these guests. We do welcome everybody tuning in coast to coast on Sirius Channel 93, and of course, all of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours on XM 209, welcome back to the show. And Jude, Carl Nafsker, 71-year-old native of Plainview, Texas, 1,109 wins for his career. His runners have earned more than $51 million in purses. He's a member of the Thoroughbred Racing Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 2008. Also a member of the Texas Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Fame and the Professional Bull Riders Ring of Honor. He has developed three champions, two Kentucky Derby winners, and most recently, Street Sense in 2007. Carl Nafsker, an honor to have him on the show tonight. Carl, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Carl, you've come a long way since Pretty Little Bessie back at Santa Fe Downs.
Not many people know Pretty Little Bessie.
Well, that was what, 1971 was your first winner?
1971, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
What do you remember about that day?
Well, I remember she went about 10 or 12 lengths, and I thought this is an easy game. But she was a real fast little filly, and that was the first year that Santa Fe Downs was open, and we went up there with 5 head, yes.
Well, when you went up there, you already had horses, but it sounds like your previous life, you were a rodeo cowboy. How did you get in that transition from the rodeo to the racehorses?
Well, being a bull rider is like anything. You're an athlete, and your days are numbered, football, baseball, whatever. And I said I wanted to get into whatever I did next in my life, I wanted to be able to do. And as I got age would be a asset instead of a liability. And I looked around. I went to the Cal Poly horseshoeing class, which goes from mid-September till mid-December, and it's 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. You study the anatomy, physiology of a horse. We built all of our own shoes out of bar stock, and it's a very, very was really a good course, because I thought, well, I've got to get into something that I can, that I enjoy, and I enjoyed horses. And then I ended up in Polo Ranch in Wyoming and breaking thoroughbreds. My dad and I bought an old thoroughbred, and Wanda and I had a little money. We got with my brothers, and we borrowed $8,000 and headed to Keeneland. And bought Pretty Little Bessie and Malicious Scene.
Wow, that's a fantastic story.
Was it a difficult transition, Carl, to make that move from being a professional bull rider, one of the best in the nation, and then move over to the thoroughbred side of things?
Anytime you leave the arena, rodeo and football, I actually tell people that when you leave the rodeo arena, it's like you go through a whole new change of life. You have been in the spotlight. You've been in the arena. Now, once you walk out, you're back into civilian life. And it's hard, but rodeoing actually set me up to be a trainer. They both had a lot of things about them. It was up to you. You got up in the morning. You fed the horses. You galloped your horses. You shod your own horses. I did. And Larry Jones is a lot like I am starting out. And you do it all. And so there's a lot of it's similar, except when you walk out of that rodeo arena, you walk out of that football field, you're a civilian now, and it's a whole different life. What did you do for me yesterday?
That's right. It's kind of a bit of a culture shock going from being the top in the sport to having five head at Santa Fe Downs. Nobody, in your case, maybe a few people at Santa Fe knew who you were, but in general, you weren't famous anymore, and you had to, you know, make a new life and make yourself famous again, which you certainly did a fine job of that.
Well, I had the best groom in the world. I had Wanda. But really what was ironic about it, I used to tell everybody all the time, I said, all the years I rode bulls, nobody called me a bull rider. And I said, now since I trained horses, everybody says, hey, you're no bull rider, is all you are.
That's funny.
You mentioned your dad as well, Carl. How long was your dad involved in your operation and kind of working with you on the thoroughbred side of things?
Dad was involved. Dad and I bought our first horse together with Ignoble. Of course, he was a $1,500 claimer. But Dad and I was involved, and I was rodeoing then full time, and it was just he never was involved. But Dad started a company. My two brothers Don and Jay, and my dad. We started a family company, and at the time of his passing, I took my mother, my brothers out. Wanda and I did. And we headed to Kentucky, and Dad passed away in 75, and in 76, I went back east to Delaware and then back to Keeneland that fall, yeah.
And, of course, your wife, Wanda, who you mentioned was part of your team in the early stages, still very much part of your team. Talk about that relationship. You met her before you moved into the training side of things, right? Doesn't that go back to the rodeo days?
Yes. I was rodeoing with a friend of mine, Pete Fredericks, and Wanda and Juanita Fredericks, which was Pete's sister. They were teaching school in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And we met Pete. Well, actually, Badine introduced us. That's Pete's other sister. And when we started going together and they ended up married, and she loves horses a whole bunch. And it was sort of a mutual decision as we walked out of rodeo, and she was teaching special education in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I was still rodeoing and breaking horses for the thoroughbred outfit up there called Polo Ranch, and we'd sell in California every spring, two-year-olds. And so both of us decided that's what we liked. We had a little money. We put some money together a little bit. And when I say a little bit, how about $8,000 to go to a horse sale with? And that's how it all started. So it was a gradual progression from riding bulls, working on this polo ranch, and shoeing horses and working together, and it just evolved. And all at once, we decided, well, that's what we wanted to do. So we decided one day in Cheyenne, we got talking. I called my brother, and we all worked things out. And we went straight from there to training horses.
So you went to Keeneland, and you bought some horses, and now you've been a perennial fixture at Keeneland ever since.
I've been to Keeneland, well, I don't know how many years now, but take the fall of 76 on, I have not missed a meet there.
Wow. Carl Nascar, a special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Carl, I'm curious, what's a bigger thrill, breaking out of the gate aboard that bull or watching your horse win the Kentucky Derby?
I'm going to surprise you there. You're going to be surprised when I tell you the answer. It's about equal, I'll tell you. Both places, you want to succeed so hard that you're literally, you're sick, yes.
You're one of the few guys that has won a couple of derbies. And talk about your first one, maybe your most famous one, of course, but talk about that.
Ms. Ginner and I, well, the only thing I can say there is Ms. Ginner was everybody's mother or grandmother, and everything you seen on TV that day was true. It was Ms. Ginner was like a grandmother to us. She was everything you seen. There was not anything about her that was not shown on TV that day. And I made the statement 3 or 4 days before the Derby. I said, if I ever win a Kentucky Derby, I want to win this one for Ms. Ginner. Because I just felt like if any lady ever deserved it, and a lot of people do, but she was a lady of ladies. She was a very special lady. The whole family, we were together. Actually, Bentley Smith, her son-in-law, the manager, passed away a year and so ago. We were together nearly exactly 30 years. So that's the kind of relationship we had with the whole family. And I just talked to Mrs. Ginter's granddaughter this afternoon. And it just, it's very special. I can't say enough. That's enough to be said, yes.
Carl, if I remember the story correctly, Mrs. Ginter really didn't even want to attend the Kentucky Derby that year, but only did it because of your urging. Is that right?
That's right. I said, you will be there. We'll put a television set in front of you, and you can watch it, and you will see it, and you will be there. Then what was ironic is when they started playing My Old Kentucky Home, it was a cloudy, cold day, and they started playing My Old Kentucky Home. The sun came out, and them old TV sets, not anybody could see anything. So that's how it worked out. I said, put Ms. Ginter by me, and I'll call the race to her. And that's how it all worked out.
And, of course, maybe one of your most defining moments of your career, being in the box with her, your quote of he's taking the lead, there he is, there he is. You were basically her eyes. And then as the horse crossed the finish line, you've won the Kentucky Derby, Mrs. Ginter. I love you. And you turned to her and gave her a kiss. And that really became, I think, probably your most defining moment. Would you agree?
I would agree, yes. It was a moment that will never happen again. Might happen, but very unlikely, because we did not know we was on television, did not know what we did for 2 weeks until Wednesday after the Derby. And it was just raw emotion, heartfelt feelings on both sides, and there was not any pretense. Now everybody, hell, like me, I know I'm Mike now. Everybody knows we're Mike. They had told me, they said, we're going to mic you, but we won't come to you, and you won't be on television until we talk to you. And I was supposed to just answer a question for Jim McKay, and I did that, and I put the mic away, and I thought that was it. Still do not know where the camera was. It's something that will probably never happen again, because everybody knows that they're on television now. Okay.
So you didn't have the urge to kiss Jim Toffel.
No, if you notice, I went yes.
Despite the fact that Mr. Toffel's such a nice man. Well, you know, when you talk about, you know, having a client for 30 years, and that doesn't happen these days anymore either. A lot of people are very fickle about trainers and all that. But when you have somebody that's a long time client like that, you just want to do so good for them. And when they win, you are so happy for them, because you know how hard it is for some people to be loyal, and the people that are loyal to you, you really appreciate.
It's something that they were good horse people, and they were that old Midwest, and they were very loyal to the people they work with. There's people like the Whittems, Paffles, that we've been the Blocks, the Miles, Steve Miles. These people have been with us over 15, 20 years, and they're with Ian now, and you know, there's a lot of people out there like that, but there's a lot of them that are not like that. Okay.
Carl, your second Kentucky Derby winner, we mentioned Street Sense, that came 17 years after Unbridled. Talk about going down that road with Jim Toffel and doing it again in 2007.
Well, there's not much to say there, Mike, because going down the road with Toffel is like skipping down the golden road. you know, he's just a man of integrity and always has been, very much integrity. And what he says, and that's it. And Mr. Toffel and I went nose to nose and head to toes to toe many a time. But when it was over, that was it. And neither one of us ever came back and said, "See, I told you I was right." And once we made a decision, we went forward with that decision. No matter if he said, "Okay, go do it," or he'd say, "No, we're going to do it." I said, "Okay, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do." And no matter who was right, it never did ever come up again. It might have come up, but it'd be in a joking way. "Well, look, I'm the one that decided that, you know," or something like that, but laughing. But it never came up as "I told you so." Never. And we've been together. He came in about 3 years after Bentley, so after the Ginner stable. So we've been together about 27 years ourselves. And when I stepped out of racing, basically as a real mainline trainer, both Mr. Toffel and Mr. Smith was in their mid-80s, and they didn't want to switch trainers. If you'll stop and think, this is my eighth year that I had moved away from being head trainer of traits, okay? So it's time goes by in a hurry.
Yeah, it really does. Well, you know, you trained Street Sense in such a way that people still talk about it today. They talk about his schedule leading up to the Derby and the Pauley track and the dirt and all the Breeders' Cup Juvenile and all of those things. Although Unbridled was your most famous moment, I think Street Sense was your most talked about horse. Talk about some of the reasons you did what you did with Street Sense.
Well, there's a lot of similarities there between Unbridled and him if you look at it. Unbridled was a learning horse and he needed more racing. Street Sense was not. But like I put Unbridled on the turf in Arlington, Secretariat at Arlington, to preparing for the Breeders' Cup Classic that year. And I did it because I felt that a turf race would get a horse a lot fitter than, and I was going back into Belmont, which I had done a terrible job with Unbridled going into the Belmont. Probably, I always tell everybody, it's the worst job I ever did. And I came back and I went in there to be prepared and fit, and he did win the Classic. Now, Street Sense was a totally different horse. He was a horse you had to understand, and I actually used the Pauley at the artificial track at Keeneland because I felt I cut myself to two races because he had already ran against the best. He had experience running against the best. I just needed to bring him fit and keyed and on and in tune, you know, and his timing and his fitness had to be there. Every race that I ran him in had to be the race that I wanted him to get. and I did not need to go somewhere and run into a muddy track or any obstacles. And I opted to go to the bluegrass. Two reasons. One, I never won it. Always wanted to win it. Still haven't won it. But I knew my track would be there, even though he might not give us the best performance. I knew he would run over it because he had ran over it at Arlington. And lack of experience is the only thing that I've seen that had hindered him. So I chose Keeneland. Was my first race I knew was going to be definite. In the first race I was going to run him back in, I wasn't for sure, and I told the press four or five races. But when he did that work, I got my work. Ian and I looked at each other. We said Tampa Bay Derby, because we knew we had just the right time to come back with a light 5/8 and then go into the Derby. And we could get the race we wanted there. So it was basically, truthfully, it was basically waiting on let the horse tell me when he was ready to start his move, because I knew when he made his first move, he had had the second move cinched if he was okay, but they both had to be good, hard races and run hard the last part. And it worked out okay.
Worked out pretty darn well. Talking with Hall of Fame trainer Carl Nasker here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Carl, not only are you a member of those three Hall of Fames I mentioned at the top of the interview, you're also an author. You wrote a book in 1994 called Traits of a Winner, The Formula for Developing Thoroughbred Racehorses. And I thought it was neat that on the inside flap of that book, it says that you are convinced that only by getting to know a horse and its needs can a trainer design an appropriate training regimen and become successful in guiding the horse along the path to racing success. In what ways, obviously you had Unbridled, Street Sense, you had so many top horses, you had Banshee Breeze. In what ways did you get to know some of those horses that brought you all that success?
Mike, it's very simple. The horse tells you. You don't have to... You're not a genius, nobody. I imagine you got Roger coming on. Roger will tell you things. These horses show you things they want to do, how they want to do it. They may have talent, and they pretty well tell you. As I always said, I've never trained a horse. Every horse has always trained me. And I just think that's an approach. At one time, I wouldn't take but 25 yearling a year. Things have changed a lot in racing now, as you know. But I, for years, would never take over 25 two-year-olds a year. And but it was a whole different league back in the 80s and that. And then, of course, when the Ginners got in, I started taking more because they had more. But I always tried to keep my number down where I would know each horse and know where we was going and what I was trying to do. And the worst thing I ever did is sometime I tried too hard to develop a horse that had already told me he wasn't any good. But I needed to get him down to 20, 25 where he was happy and I was happy. But I probably maybe tried too hard on too many horses that I should have been a little smarter on. But no, I never did train a horse, Mike. Horses always train me. I learn all the races that they run. I'm looking at the next race. And I've had a lot of fun with racehorses. Let's put it that way.
Carl, you mentioned it's been 8 years, hard to believe, since you walked away from being a mainstream trainer. It had to be an excruciatingly difficult decision, I would imagine. How tough was that?
It was not tough.
Really?
No, I did it like I did rodeoing. I trained hard, I worked hard, and I'm still heavily involved with Ian. And I like doing, I do a lot of chiropractic, my own deal, go over a lot of, I like working around horses, I like listening to horses, and I do a lot of work with horses, and I enjoy it. So it wasn't hard because I'm still involved, okay?
Yeah, that's one of the things that if you do step away, because I stepped away from training in 2000, and I was lucky enough to run a couple of farms, and that's where I met Mr. Toffel, was at the old 505 farm.
Okay.
But, you know, as long as you're around the horses, that makes everything all right, because it's really the horses that drive the game, and your love of the horses is what carries you through, and I'm sure that it's that way for you. You've just explained that eloquently.
Well, I don't I'm like this, you know, people just get out of the way. Horse racing is a great game. It's the horse is a great animal, and I can't say enough of what the horse has done for me. I can't say how much fun it is to watch a horse change, watching come to you, watching open up to you, and then become what he is. And as I said in my book, Mike, you mentioned it, I said in the book two things. I said, number one, if you cannot watch a $5,000 claimer run that gives you 110% and enjoy it, you don't need to be in the game. I didn't say keep him. But you got to enjoy a little horse that just gives you everything he's got. And secondly, there's a paragraph in the book, and I can't quote it, but it's in about the sixth page. It says, there's 1,000 ways to train a racehorse, but there's only one end result that is acceptable, and that is for a horse to relax and respond to his rider's command. And that goes to dressage, reining, roping, anything. It's like them old bucking horses rodeoing. They loved it. I mean, some of them 18 years old. I mean, they just love bucking. They just open that gate and they give you 8 seconds. So they'd hear that buzzer, they'd just sort of go hopping around there to the pickup man. And so it's been, horses have been a great part of my life, and I'm happy to be a partner with them.
The great Carl Nafsker, our special guest here tonight on Trainer Talk. Carl, you have always been tremendously accommodating with your time for me and for Jude whenever we've asked you. We certainly appreciate it. We could have spent another half an hour with you, but Roger's on deck, so we appreciate you being here.
Well, tell Roger hello for me, okay?
Thanks
Will
so
do.
Much, Carl.
Okay, thank you, bye-bye. Carl.
Hall of Famer Carl Nafsker. Wow. I feel like we're just getting started, don't you?
I know. That was about the fastest half hour I think we've ever done.
Just amazing. Right. Roger Atfield up next. Second half of Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train. It's time to get on board.
Group winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a group one. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjoux and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
You can be a better bettor just by knowing how a horse is working.
For the first time ever, RacingWithBruno.com's reports are available straight from the source.
Racing with Bruno's With the Works takes you behind the past performances into the morning routines that matter most.
With over 20 years of experience, our team of analysts specialize in first-time starters and layoff horses, as well as full-card workout reports and selections.
Go to RacingWithBruno.com.
Now with the works.
The Wizards betting window is now new and improved. Available exclusively at DRF.com, the Wizards betting window takes the work out of wagering by giving you just the Wizards' best plays and strongest opinions for wagering recommendations at top tracks around the country. Along with win and plays, the betting window includes pick threes, pick fours, and pick sixes, and 10-cent superfectas wherever possible. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the betting window. It's like no other handicapping sheet on the market. Only the Wizards betting window offers real real-time changes to reflect late scratches, changing track and weather conditions, late equipment changes, and more. Just download the betting window while you do your handicapping in advance and then receive an updated final edition 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. The betting window final edition will be delivered right to your inbox so you can receive it anywhere you wager. Use the Wizard's best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try the Wizard's betting window today. That's drf.com/wizbw.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
This is HRRN, your exclusive home for Kentucky Derby 139.
And welcome back to HRN's final furlong show, this Wednesday Trainer Talk edition, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. A Hall of Fame edition of the show rolling on. A great visit with trainer Carl Nasker in the first half of the show. If you missed any portion, there will be a podcast available for you on our website by tomorrow. You'll get a chance to go back and listen. You can also listen on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Roger Atfield, the 73-year-old native of Newbury, England, going to be with us for the next half an hour. 1,754 career wins. His runners have amassed in excess of $91 million in purses. Think about that. Roger won the Sovereign Award for Outstanding Canadian Trainer a record 8 times. He trained 3 Canadian Triple Crown winners, 6 Canadian Horse of the Year winners, 8 winners of the Queen's Plate, and 44 Sovereign Award winners. In 1999, Roger was inducted into the Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame. And last year, and we were there for this, it was a tremendous honor, Roger was inducted into the American Horse Racing Hall of Fame. And he's nice enough to spend some time with us here tonight. Roger, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Roger. And I'm curious, when I run down your resume like that, and I'm sure I've left out some of the accolades because you've had so many, what goes through your mind when you look back on your career and you hear those numbers?
Well, it's been a great career, and it's hopefully still going. When I first came over and started training flat horses, when I got away from the jumping horses, and I sort of planned in my mind that I was going to win the Queen's Plate one day, and that was about as far as I really thought, you know. And it's just been a wonderful career for me, and I'm very blessed.
Yeah, take us back to the beginning. You mentioned the jump horses growing up in England. You were obviously a very accomplished steeplechase rider. Talk about the early days of Roger Atfield and what led you to eventually get into thoroughbreds.
Well, I started riding ponies at quite a young age, played with local riding schools, and my parents didn't have the money to buy me ponies or anything, so I sort of did it my own way, and I did, you know, milk rounds and paper rounds and all kinds of things to get enough money to go to local riding schools when I was very young. And I was fortunate enough to start riding ponies for various horse dealers in England and did very well. And, I went to agricultural college for a while and did that. And then when I came out from there, I started my own business up, which was a small farm, and the horses were always the main part of it. And, I continued on with my show jumping, and I did some amateur steeplechase riding as well. And I came to Canada to actually carry on with that. But I realized that it wasn't the same kind of circuit that I was used to in Europe, where we were riding shows every day virtually. And I went down to the racetrack to help a trainer at that was working for Frank Stronach, when Frank actually only had like 6 racehorses at that time and a 25-acre farm in Canada, and I went down to help them out because they were short of help. And I got looking around and I thought, well, I can't ride jumpers forever, and I think it's time I've moved into, you know, another discipline. So I went to, with the, you know, started training the flat horses.
And you started in Canada with a relatively small stable, is that correct?
Yeah, I took a private job with a gentleman called Roy Kennedy, who was a Canadian, but he had farms in Ocala and was developing a lot of Ocala at that time, and was actually the instigator and the person that started the OBS sales there and what have you. But at that time, he just raced like 6 or 7 horses, really, and also sell in yearlings. In fact, we sold No Class to Mr. Samuels of Sampson Farms when they were first going to get into the thoroughbred business. And of course, No Class went, he named her No Class, and of course she went on to be the foundation mare for his whole stable that did it also very, very well in international racing.
Roger, I have to admit, with all the research I did for the interview here today, I was scouring the internet trying to find out who your first winner was and when that occurred. Who was the very first winner you ever saddled?
I believe it was a horse called Cool Wonder. He was out of a great mare called Wonderware. And that was for Roy Kennedy. And that would have been probably in 1971. And I believe it was Cool Wonder.
Well, you certainly have
come
saddled
a long way.
Many winners. 91 million dollars in purses. You're only 9 million away. Certainly, you can whip that out in a couple of years.
I don't know the way. The way my stable looks at this particular point of time, it might take a while. But I don't know where all that money went. But anyway, people ask me, and I say, if I hadn't had so many horses and so many divorces, I probably would have kept a lot of it.
Yeah, know? That's right. The trainer's lament.
Hall of Fame trainer Roger Atfield, our special guest here tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. Roger, would I be correct in saying that your first major horse, if we want to use that term, would have been Norcliffe? Is that right?
Yes, it would have been. That was probably a big turnaround in my career, actually, because after training privately for a few years, 2 or 3 years with Roy Kennedy, I went public and with a very, very weak stable, with a lot of cheap horses, and I was asked by Colonel Charles Baker, who was the chairman of the Jockey Club at that time, if I would train privately for him, and he just bought this yearling that he was really, really very confident it was going to be a good horse, and named it Norcliffe. And I finished up taking that job and came down to Payson Park in Florida in 1974 with him as a yearling going too. And he went on to be champion 2-year-old, and he gave me my first Queen's Plate winner. And that probably was a big turnaround in my career, actually.
And that, of course, led to you eventually being associated with Bud Wilmot and King Haven Farms. Of course, you mentioned Frank Stronach. Talk about those relationships and how that came about.
Well, I trained for Colonel Baker for, I don't know how many years it was now, but quite a few years. And I knew the Wilmots very well, you know, through Colonel Baker and through, you know, being at the races in the afternoon, and I got to know them quite well. And a good friend of mine from England actually started to manage their farm, and they approached me two or three times to train for them privately, and at that point of time I'd gone public again and was still training some horses for Colonel Baker, but he cut down quite a bit, so I went public. And eventually I decided that I would definitely take the job with King Haven, and we had a great run together, and we had some many good horses, and it was a great time actually. And Mr. Wilmot Senior was just a wonderful fellow, and it was just a good time, you know.
Well, one of those horses that kind of launched you into prominence with King Haven was a horse by the name of With Approval, who won the Canadian Triple Crown. Talk about With Approval, what he meant to you and to your career, and how special he really was.
Yeah, I mean, he was a horse that was an interesting little horse. He was an interesting horse to train, and a very inquisitive horse. We used to call him Snoopy, actually, and very smart horse, liked to take a lot of time in the morning standing and looking around. And I knew as a 2-year-old that he was going to be a really nice horse, and it was quite evident to me that he was wanting to be a turf horse. But the Triple Crown, because with the first two legs were on the dirt, and he sort of gave us heart attacks in those races because he just really didn't like the dirt. He just wanted it on class. And then once he stepped on the turf, he became, the monster. And he had a devastating quarter-mile kick. I mean, when he was ridden that way, I still feel very upset that he didn't win the Breeders' Cup, because I think he was the best horse, but he couldn't sustain a 3.5 furlong drive, you know. But he was, he took us various places, and I think he still holds the world record for three eights, actually, that he set in the Bowling Green in New York. But he was just a lovely horse to be around, and did very well for us, obviously.
Well, I've admired your work for many, many years. I've cashed many bets on Roger Adfield horses, it's just uncanny to me how you'll get a horse from Europe and they go straight to the winner's circle, or you'll bring one up and they win race after race after race. What's the secret?
Well, I think you have to have a decent horse in the first place, and but the main thing I think is just basic horsemanship, really. And horsemanship, as far as I'm concerned, is being able to understand each animal. They're all individuals. They all need various training regimes. I mean, some need others and some need less, and they sort of tell you that if you're around them enough. And I'm very hands-on, always on my pony with them in the morning. And if you keep those kind of horses happy in very good condition and happy, they're going to perform for you.
Roger, that's interesting to hear you say that. When Carl was on with us in the first half of the show, he talked about how he never really trained a horse, but the horses more trained him. I guess that sounds like the same philosophy.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the basis of any discipline in horses, it's just common sense horsemanship, and you can't just set a program out and say, I mean, if you could do that, you could go away for 3 or 4 months and say, well, this is what we do each day of the week, and we work them here, and da 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 da. It doesn't work that way. You've got to change your programs to fit in with what the horse is telling you, if you start doing things wrong by them, then they're not going to perform for you, and it's probably going to spiral downhill too,
Roger, who were some of the people, or maybe the singular person, that had the biggest influence on your career?
Well, it was probably an old horse dealer in England when I was quite young, that really taught me, or, you know, I'd learned by watching him and listening to him, you know, over what I was just really saying, you know, over just, you know, sensible horsemanship. And, you know, he wasn't a well-known horseman by any respect, but I think he was probably one of the best horsemen that I'd been around, and I learned a tremendous amount from him, and, you know, I always listened in to any of his conversations when I was just a small boy, and I took as much in as I could, because I thought that he was the best that I'd ever been around, you know.
And why was Canada the right place for Roger Atfield, as opposed to maybe the United States or someplace else?
Well, there was no magic to that, actually. I just felt that I'd gone through a period in England, personally, that I felt that I just needed to get away and go somewhere else for a change. And I didn't have any set plans on, you know, it could have been Australia, you know. The only country that I knew anybody in was Canada. I just had one friend in Canada who, you know, I called and said, you know, what does it take to emigrate to Canada? And, you know, at that particular point of time, he just needed a letter of employment and pass a medical, and you were immigrated. You know, it was about a three-week situation in those days. And that's where I came to Canada. I mean, it could have been anywhere, really.
One of the hallmarks of Roger Atfield horses is that they have careers, not just meets. You've raced horses that have raced well into advanced age. Musketeer comes to mind. I was having lunch with a friend this afternoon, and he said, "Oh, Musketeer, one of my favorite horses." Talk about keeping a horse around till he's 10 years old, and what that entails.
Well, he was a charm to be around. Actually, he was just such a nice horse, and he had a few idiosyncrasies. He was a little bit claustrophobic in stalls that were a little bit, you know, not really wide open and a lot of light. You know, at Payson Park, he was always okay. Woodbine, it used to bother him some, and we used to keep him outside as much as possible. I had a big pen by my office that I turned horses out in for, you know, short periods of time every morning, and he finished up more or less taking that particular one over, and he'd live out, when the weather was right, he'd be out there just about all day long, and that's what he liked to do. And when in the winter, you know, I come down to Payson Park, and it's a great place for those kind of horses, because you can't really stop on those horses totally. You could turn them out, but they need to be ridden also a little bit. And, you know, there's a lot of land to hack around and just play around with him and just get him really happy and playing and, you know, just keeping him happy, you know. And, you know, he was just a great horse, because he just kept giving it back to me, you know.
Roger, we talked about the great With Approval a short time ago. When you look back at your career, what are some of the other horses that are going to hold a special place in your heart that you're never going to forget?
Well, gosh, there's so many of them, but one, there was Izvestia was a very, very good horse, and it was devastating to me that the last race of his career, that he broke his leg and had to be destroyed. And you know, he was a very, very sound horse and a very talented horse. I should have done better with him as a four-year-old. His throat got messed up at the beginning of the season, and never could get it quite sorted out, but he actually was, you know, he was a brilliant horse. And when he won the Triple Crown, I knew going into the Triple Crown, unless something physical went wrong, there was no way that they were going to beat him. I mean, and he won all three legs of the Triple Crown. I mean, he just won off in all of those races. And then because he did the same thing after that in the Molson Million against, you know, horses that had won the Belmont and I can't remember the Kentucky Derby winner, I think, was there. But he was a very, very special horse, and it was the biggest upset of my career when he broke down and had to be destroyed. So he was very special. And there was another horse that wasn't that well known, but Play the King was a real, real professional racehorse, and always gave you everything he possibly could, you know. And he was probably my biggest favorite of all the horses I've ever trained, just because of his character and his grit, you know.
When I think of Roger Atfield, I think the one horse that stands out to me is a horse called Peetski, who I was a big fan of. Thought he was just a tremendous racehorse, and Roger, mm-hmm. you did a tremendous job with him.
Yeah, I was upset in that too. I mean, you know, I went to the third Santa Anita with him to the Breeders' Cup Classic with big hope, you know, real high hopes, and you know, he had to be scratched in one of the races, and it turned out that we retired him off of that, but he'd been a sound horse all the way through. It was just terrible, terrible timing, and you know, things happen, and you know, what can you do about it? But it was very upsetting, you know, for everybody, because he was, and I'd always said that he was going to be a fantastic 4-year-old on the turf, and I believe he would have been, you know. But you know, these things happen.
And of course, I mentioned a dual Hall of Fame member. You can't say that about too many trainers in this game, Roger. Obviously a member of the Canadian Hall of Fame, and then last year we were there for your induction into the American Racing Hall of Fame. Quite an accomplishment. How much did that mean to you to be inducted into the American Hall of Fame?
Oh, a tremendous amount. I mean, I was very, very honored to go into the hall, you know, with so many people that I've admired over the years, and it was a very, very special moment for me, no question about that.
Well, you told a great story in your induction speech, and it was a steeplechase-related story, and I don't remember it. I tried to go back and find it in our archives, and I couldn't find it. Do you remember what that story was?
Well, I think you're talking about a joke that I told.
Yes. Yeah. Is it fit for radio?
Yeah, I can be, yes. It's kind of a... Did you want me to tell it?
Yeah, please
do. It was great.
It was great.
Well, it was a story about people writing to instructions. And there was this young lad that was ready to have his first ride steeplechasing, and he was just waiting for somebody to give him a chance. And this old trainer said to him, he said, "I'll give you a chance to ride if you promise to ride to instructions. Do you ride to instructions? Do you listen to what we're saying?" And he said, "Oh, yes, sir, I certainly do." So he said, "Okay." So he was booked on the horse, and in the paddock, the trainer's giving him his leg up, and he said, "Now listen, son," he said, "when you go to every fence that you come to, you say 1, 2, 3, hup, 1, 2, 3, hup." "Okay, yes, sir, I will." So anyway, the tapes went up, and the horses were all charging down to the first fence, and the boy was sitting in amongst all these professionals, and he thought, "I sound like a real idiot, just saying 1, 2, 3, up to this horse." So he just sat still, and the horse hit the fence, fell on the other side of his head, and skidded along the ground on his knees, and scrambled up again, and the boy was still on him, but the field was 16th of a mile ahead. So he started just riding along, and 1, 2, 3, hup, 1, 2, 3, hup. He's jumping, and he catches up to the field, and he's going through the field, 1, 2, 3, hup, and anyway, he finishes third. He came back, and the trainer said to him, "Listen, you little son of a gun." He said, "You didn't write the instructions. You didn't say 1, 2, 3, up to that horse at that first fence." He said, "Oh, yes, sir, I did." But he said, "I think he's deaf." He said, "He's not deaf, son. He's blind."
That is a great joke. And again, part of Roger's acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame inductions last year.
Yeah, that was a highlight. You're going into the Hall of Fame and us being there, that was really great for us. We were glad to be a part of that day, and it was so nice of you to come and talk to us afterwards. A very busy day for you, and just sensational. You and Johnny Velasquez ended up winning a stakes together, I believe, the day before the induction. Was that correct?
But to be honest with you, the day before, my significant other rides on the American dressage team, and we were in at the Olympics, and I couldn't stay for the last ride because I needed to be in Saratoga, of course. So it was quite ironic that the two things all happened at the same time. But I think that I believe Johnny did write the state, but I wasn't actually there for it. But I believe he did.
Yeah, I believe it was the Hall of Fame stakes, actually, is the one that Johnny won, if I'm not mistaken, aboard your trainee, Roger. And I'm glad you brought up the Olympics. Sure. I was going to ask you about that because I knew you made it back for the inductions a bit later than you wanted to. But talk about that, and you mentioned your significant other. Is she still active in competing?
Yeah, actually, she's set to... on her way back from Wellington, and where the competition in the next couple of days, actually. But yes, she certainly is. Yeah.
That's got to be a thrill for you to participate in that as well as racing. Can you talk about that a minute?
Well, yeah, it's actually a very difficult discipline. When I was riding in England, I did just a little tiny weeny bit that which was part of the three day event. This cross country course, a little dressage competition, and then a show jump in over the 3 days. And the dressage was always my weakest part. And I appreciate the difficulty of dressage at that level, at the Grand Prix level to world class level, like she was riding, and it's kind of horse after horse after horse, I think, for the layman. But if you understand how difficult those movements are, and how you have to ride, it's quite it's very interesting, and then. But I must admit that when I go to those things, I slip off and go over to the show jump in ring quite a bit.
your old pursuit. You go to what you know. Safe to assume that she doesn't ask you for pointers, huh?
That's right.
And Roger, just is her name pronounced Tina or Tanya?
It's Tina.
Tina. All right, Tina. Yeah. There we go. All right, Tina. All right, well, Roger, look, we're about out of time. Hard to believe it's been a half an hour already. It's been an awful lot of fun, and can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit with us here tonight, and really, really do appreciate it. We'll look forward to catching up with you up the road and watching you close in on many more milestones.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that a lot, and I hope that happens.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Have a good night.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Good night.
Dual Hall of Fame trainer Roger Atfield, rounding out trainer talk tonight, a Hall of Fame edition. Wow.
Yes.
I mean, I have chills listening to these trainers that are at the top of the game tell those stories. You know, it's amazing.
And it seems, and this is totally accidental, but a lot of times there's a common thread that flows through these shows, and you listen to one trainer and then you listen to the next. And you know, tonight's theme was Let the Horse Tell You. Other nights we've had, stories about everybody working for Jack Vanberg or whatever, but it's very cool.
We should have had these shows before when you were training? Because you could have probably picked up on a couple of things, and maybe we'd be talking to you as a Hall of Fame trainer.
I think it's fascinating. I like to listen to people. You know,
well, if you missed
some, I'll be on Trainer Talk when somebody doesn't show up.
If you missed any portion of the show, a podcast available on our website, horseracingradio.net, by tomorrow. And of course, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We're back 3 to 7 Eastern time tomorrow afternoon with our HRN live programming. Our listener call-in show is the final furlong show from 6 to 7. You can visit horseracingradio.net for more information. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penham. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.